The portfolio doctors are Dan Osgood and Stephen Bick, who are investment advisor representatives of their respective registered investment advisor firms, ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management Company LLC. The opinions expressed by the portfolio doctors and guests on this radio show are their own and do not reflect the opinions of this radio station. All statements and opinions expressed are based upon information considered reliable, although it should not be relied upon as such. Any statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Moreover, no listener should assume that any discussions or information presented serves as the recipient of or a substitute for personalized advice from ACAS LLC, Cottingham Management LLC, or from any other investment professional and is not intended as an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management LLC are not law or accounting firms, and no portion of this presentation should be interpreted as legal, accounting, or tax advice. Information expressed does not take into account your specific situation or objectives and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for any listener. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from a qualified tax, legal, or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation.
You're listening to The Portfolio Doctors on ESPN 1700. Your financial future depends on making sound investment decisions. Make sure you get accurate information and a weekly checkup from a source you can trust, Portfolio Doctors. Now, live in studio, here's Dan Osgood and Steve Bick, The Portfolio Doctors.
Welcome. Happy Friday, everyone. Although we're not sure if anyone will be listening on a day like today, it's likely everyone's heading for the beach, but we're going to assume there's still a few of you out there listening. This is The Portfolio Doctors. My name is Dan Osgood. Your name is?
No, I left for the beach, Tim. My name's Steve Bick.
So you're not listening.
I'm out of here. Your idea was way better than staying around here.
You know.
Yeah.
Every once in a while I come up with a good idea.
That's it. Now, I'm Steve Bick, and we're happy to be here. Hopefully we can bring you up to speed.
Yes, and that we want to quickly go over what our goal of this show is and has always been, and that is just to help educate, give information that it can be used for you and your own personal situation, not to listen to what the talking heads on CNBC or any of the other financial outlets, the business section of the paper, that are always telling you the sky is falling or hooray, this report came out, so everything's all better. Because if you watch that on a day-to-day basis, you're pulling out your hair and it can cause you to go a little bit insane.
Yeah. I mean, what it's called is whipsawed around. I mean, it's, you know, you one day you're bullish on the market, next day you're bearish, you're in, you're out, and you lose focus of the long-term goals, what you're really trying to get out of a portfolio. And really what you end up doing is focusing on just things that oftentimes don't even really matter or happen.
Right.
It's just speculation. It's just a ton of speculation out there. And so you've got to just really try and pull back and take a 30,000 foot view. And oftentimes you're better served. And when you can identify a good opportunity, you jump on it. And outside of that, you know, you obviously want to keep up with what's going on in the market. But as you say, you need to form your own opinion based on your own rational input.
Right. And understand, most of what you hear is just noise. It's very, very short-sighted. And yes, it may have an impact, but if you watch, it may only impact for 1 or 2 days, sometimes a week or two, and then you look and the market's right back on track. We've seen that this year a few times already, and we're only barely into May.
Well, yeah, but if you look at the market, I mean, it is up and it's near all-time highs, but what's it up about 1% for the year? I mean,
right.
It's struggling. There's no doubt about that. We've spoken at length about this, where the momentum stocks have really lost their momentum, and that's normally a sign that there's a start of a little bit of a bearish-type stance on the market. You need these momentum names to keep pushing this higher. And particularly today, I mean, they had job numbers coming out, and you would have thought based on just the headline number that we could have had a big rally.
Right.
But in fact, the market ended down for the day.
Right. And that, we've talked about this a number of times as well. It could be the good news is bad news situation where the QE, all the federal bond buying, has been propping up this market for so long, and people are afraid, they're not sure what's going to happen as soon as that goes away. So every time there's good news, that just encourages the Fed to continue tapering and reducing it. They did that again this week.
Well, yeah. I mean, you had jobs, what, 288,000 jobs. You had the unemployment rate fall to 6.3% from 6.7%. I mean, that's a massive drop.
Right.
A lot of that they've put down to potentially the bad weather during the winter stop people from actually finding work. But when you really clear away the weeds to all these reports, and that's what I'm saying, based on the headline report, it seemed that the market should rally. But when you clear away the weeds and you actually see what's under there, a lot of that success in terms of the unemployment rate dropping from 6.7 to 6.3 was that over 800,000 people left the workforce.
Right.
They fell off the end of the unemployment benefit spectrum. So that really, suddenly when you look at it as a labor participation rate, and that's how and what percentage of the population is actually participating or has a job, it's at the lowest level since 1978.
Wow.
So when you look at it from that vantage point, it's not looking good. Now, if you're a college graduate, the unemployment rate's down around 3.3%. But the problem is when you look outside of the college graduate bucket, which is a vast majority of people mm-hmm. out there, they just can't find jobs. They're either flipping burgers or they're in some temporary work or I mean, you know, it's just there's nothing out there for them to get.
There's a pretty interesting viewpoint here on Bloomberg, and the whole title of it is A Nation of Temps and Burger Flippers, ? And one of the best stats it shows is the prominence of temporary employment almost 5 years into this recovery is not a good sign.
No.
And it's basically suggesting that companies are hiring through unemployment services rather than putting new workers on their payrolls, which tends to be a practice that, one, makes firing those employees a lot easier.
Sure.
And it kind of makes you feel pretty cautious about the economic outlook, at least from a business owner standpoint.
No, without a doubt. And the other side of it is the cost of a temp is just way lower because you don't often have to factor in health benefits and, you know, all of these other things you have to factor in. I know I have a business in Hawaii. And over there, you have to provide, you know, not only the Social Security benefits, which costs an employer 6 to 7%, right? Mm-hmm. You've also got to put on disability, plus workers' comp, plus I've got to put healthcare over there. So to hire a full-time employee costs me a fortune.
Right.
I mean, you might only pay them $2,000 a month, but it's actually costing you, you know, close to $2,500, $2,600 a month for that person.
And magnify that times a business with 10 or 20 employees.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, the cost to do business is growing rapidly.
I know. So the point that that we're trying to make is, you know, the market went down, and it seemed like with a 6.3% unemployment rate, that it should have gone, it should have accelerated. But as you say, the other side to the coin with that is, it definitely gives the Fed all the ammunition it needs to be able to continue to taper. And so it's looking more and more like by August or October, we're going to be that the stimulus will be gone.
Right.
But the other interesting part to this whole thing is that the bond yields went down,
right?
Which is very, very interesting because the interest rate actually dropped. Now, the one thing that happened out in the macroeconomic environment was in Ukraine just seems to be blowing up in everyone's faces.
Right. There was a kind of, I don't know if it's overnight, I don't know the time differences, but in the Ukraine, there was an aggressive act from Ukraine against the Soviet troops.
Correct.
And they shot, there were two helicopters shot down and numerous casualties.
Right. So that doesn't bode well for a stock market.
Oh, but yeah. Basically, Vladimir Putin said that this basically eliminates any chance of a peaceful resolution.
He took his shirt off again?
I think so. He had an alligator under one arm.
Okay, right.
Crocodile under the other.
There you go. But yeah, what's the difference between those two, other than one's bigger than the other? But I mean, with that type of uncertainty, that's another reason why you could have potentially seen stocks down on the back of good economic news on the unemployment front. But when yields start dropping, then that's very interesting because that means the one fear that everyone has is inflation coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we looked at the yields today, we saw that there was a flattening of the yield curve
is flattening.
And certainly what that means is the difference between what you get paid interest on a 30-year note versus what you get paid on a one-year note. If it's very sharp, in other words, you're getting a lot more interest on a 30-year note.
So for real numbers, we'll assume and make it easy, say on a one-year bond, you're going to get paid 1% on a 30.
Where is that bond?
No, this is hypothetical.
Let's say more realistic, 0.2%. Okay.
Just for ease of numbers, assume it's 1% for 1 year.
Okay.
And if it was a crazy market at 30 years, it would normally be 30%.
Oish.
Okay. Just for illustration purposes, so it's easy to say 1, 2, 3.
Okay. In that scenario that Dan just gave us, we would be expecting hyperinflation because that 30-year note's trying to factor in all the inflation all the way over there, right? So that's really what it's showing you. On the flip side, if you had, and I actually traded, when I was in London, I was trading bonds, and back then it was 97, 98. Mm-hmm. And for those of you that don't remember, we had what was called an inverted yield curve, meaning that the 30-year bonds were giving you less of a return than the 2-year or the 10-year bonds. I mean, that's upside down to normal. But what it meant was that everyone looking forward just didn't see any inflation. They just saw that the economy has actually got more problems of cooling down and there being a deflationary mm-hmm. environment. Well, with this flattening of the yield curve that we're seeing now, we're actually getting to a point where people looking out and they just not seeing inflation in this market.
Right.
Now, that's very interesting.
So that's saying if that 1% for 1 year and 30% for 30 years were the normal standard, if everything was functioning properly.
Yeah, we had like one and five.
Right. It's getting much closer to the same.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, if you look at that, if you've got a limited amount of inflation, and in actual fact, the blog I wrote today addressed this exact concern, and I mean, actually, it's a fairly long topic, so I'm not going to bring it up right now. Maybe we can
get to that in the next segment.
Yeah.
Well, as we talk about these different topics, we really love hearing from our listeners with questions, comments, any financial aspect that you want covered or you want clarity on, something we talk about. We definitely would love to hear from you. You can reach either of us via email. My email is dan@theportfoliodoctors.com. Steve's is steve@theportfoliodoctors.com. Or you can just go to our website, theportfoliodoctors.com, and that is plural, theportfoliodoctors.com. And just punch your name in the email. We'll add you to our list. We'll get back to you as soon as we can with any answers to questions. We'll be back shortly. Doctors. My name is Dan Osgood.
I'm Steve Bick.
And we are here to help point you in the right direction when it comes to your finances, your retirement, and everything about your financial life. The topic of inflation, we kind of threw that up.
Yeah, we were talking about that before we went to the break, and we were talking about how a flattening yield curve, what that means in terms of the market's outlook for inflation. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be relatively weak.
The market overall is pretty intuitive historically.
Well, the bond market.
It anticipates what's going to happen ahead of time, and generally things tend to follow what it's expecting.
Yeah, and as I was saying before we went to the break, I mean, I write a blog every week for those of you that want to follow it. It's at cottinghamstockseries.blogspot.com. Remember that if you can.
You can go to our website, theportfoliodoctors.com, exactly. and we'll get you added if you want to.
There you go. But yeah, the blog today was on this inflationary outlook and interest rates, I mean, my view on it, which is contrary to consensus. Consensus says we've had interest rates really low for a long period of time. They've got to start going up at some point. I actually disagree. I actually think they could go lower.
Right.
And the reason I think they could, well, there's three main reasons. The first one is the Fed needs them to stay low. Mm-hmm. And they've mentioned that they're going to.
That's one of the biggest ones, aren't
they?
Well,
that's
pretty
big.
Our country needs them to stay low.
Well, the whole country, exactly, not just the Fed. I mean, you take an example. I think our budget deficit is estimated to be around $600 billion this year. Now, that includes interest payments, right? Interest payments on our debt are running around about $200 billion. So it's about a third of that budget deficit. If you take interest rates and rack them up to 6%, that takes the interest payments up another $650 billion. It doubles the budget deficit. It takes it from a $600 billion deficit to a $1.2 trillion deficit. Now, that's something that's impactful.
That's a substantial number.
Huge. And that's only with paying an interest rate of 5 or 6%. I mean, and 5 and 6% is not high by historic standards.
Right.
It's still pretty low. But just a slight move in this interest rate is really going to undo any form of trying to balance the budget. I mean, you've almost got a bigger, I think actually at that point, it is almost the bigger piece of the whole budget than the defense and everything else.
Well, that's when the trillion-dollar coin becomes a reality.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't help because you're not just printing more
right,
debt.
It makes that debt go away, though.
Yeah.
The deficit.
Yeah, exactly.
Gone.
Well, I mean, they don't even incorporate all the money they're borrowing for Social Security, but that's another topic. But anyway, so the point of the matter is Congress, government, and the Fed are all basically want these interest rates to stay low. So that's point number one. The second point is if you look across the globe, you just take a broad array of countries around the globe and you look at their 10-year treasuries or their 10-year notes, right? Japan is at 10 years at 0.6%. Switzerland's at 0.8. Germany's, I think, at just over 1. France is at 1.7. And so those are the lowest ones. But that's still miles away. We're at 2.6. I mean, we're way out there. In fact, to put it into comparison with other countries, you've got a situation where, remember Spain and Italy, and they were about to go bankrupt just a year or so ago? They're basically at the same rate as we are. Mexico and Portugal are only a percentage point higher than the United States. So it's really just crazy that we've got a situation where our interest rates, and it sounds crazy, but are so high.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, you're a global bond manager and you're looking around the globe, where should I allocate my next $400 billion? If I was looking around and doing my old job back where I was trading, you know, $1 billion a year, I'd be looking at the U.S. going, man, look at those yields.
High yield.
Yeah, not only are those yields high, the currency is relatively stable. The economy is pretty stable. The jobless rates are looking pretty good. I mean, you know, that would be a place I'd be looking at.
You have to look and say the U.S. debt is probably near the top of the ones that you can feel comfortable about that it's going to be able to pay.
Well, that is an issue. And that's one of the reasons why Europe's a lot lower is because they've taken the choice of austerity versus printing money. So there's the two differences, right? And now if you think about the austerity program, what's happened is they've got massive unemployment. We think our unemployment rate's bad at 6.3. I mean, you go to Spain, it's at like 26% or something ridiculous. And so what you've got is you've got a situation where they are staring down the barrel of deflation. Now, that's the third point to my equation, is that normally in these situations, if you look at the yield curve and you see it starting to rise, it's for an expectation of inflation. Right now, with Europe potentially exporting deflation, along with China exporting deflation, along with Japan exporting deflation, there's a high probability that we get stuck in this low interest rate environment. The Fed could stop printing money tomorrow and you might see the bond yield drop. And so, I mean, and in that situation, it's one of these cases where the world might be entering a situation where in the next 5, 10, 15 years, we still at interest rates below 2%. And what that does is it just absolutely decimates retirees' savings. I mean, saving money almost becomes a bad idea because if you can only get 2 or 3%, think about it. If you're sitting on $1 million out there and you're expecting 6% return on your money, so you're going to get 60 grand a year, that's 5 grand a month, you're probably okay. Add to Social Security, you know, 7 grand a month, you're probably living okay. You take down to 2% return on your money, you've gone from 60,000 to 20. That 5 grand a month is now $1,500 or $1,600 a month, plus the 2 grand. I mean, you really are hurting.
Right.
And this is the stark reality to people who are listening to the show, is that if the future for the next 10 years is one of muted inflation, slow growth, because everyone's finally woken up to the fact that we're probably only going to grow at like 2.5% GDP. So slow growth, relatively high unemployment rates, and no inflation and low yields. I mean, that's an entirely different investment scenario to the one that's being presented to you on TV, for sure.
Absolutely.
And so with that in case in point, lower yields end up, oftentimes you get to a point where the stock market's, you know, run its way. A lot of the increase or the goodness in the earnings has come off the back of being able to reduce their cost of debt, but that's left. So now you're relying on a consumer to prop up the market. And so, you know, you might have seen the highs in the market for a while, even with low interest rates. You go look at Japan, they haven't got even close back to their highs. And they've been in a deflationary environment for
more than 20 years now.
Yeah, deflation's terrible for stocks. Mm-hmm. Terrible. I mean, because everything gets cheaper all the time. And you think of your Apple. So you're going to buy an Apple for an iPhone today for $500, where you can buy it in a week for $495 and in 2 weeks for $450. Everyone just puts off their purchases. And that's really what Japan's struggling with. Trying to kickstart the economy is almost impossible.
Get people out spending money.
Yeah. So when you're earning nothing on your savings, it's actually a benefit because you really are growing because the cost of everything's dropping. It's hard to imagine because we haven't had that in this country.
Right.
But that is actually really hard to pull yourself out of that spiral.
And it's not out of the realm of possibilities.
No, with Europe looking at it. I mean, Europe's growth, we complaining because our GDP is looking at growing at 2.2 to 2.5 is what they're estimating, which probably means we're looking at 1 to 1.5 because they're always at too bullish. Europe is looking at like 0.2 to 0.3. I mean, they are on the precipice of not, and it's not a recession, but it's just, they're on the precipice of deflation.
Just no growth.
Just, well, not worse than no growth. Just negative
growth.
Negative growth, but based on prices that are spiraling lower, not based on the fact that everything's contracting, just based on everything costs less all the time.
Right. That, if you have extra money, that's not the worst thing.
No, if you're sitting on cash, but I mean, if you take Japan, they've been sitting on cash for 15, 20 years. I mean, you know, that's the problem with this. It's not a quick fix. You don't just, particularly look at us. We've tried to print inflation. Mm-hmm. We've spent $3 or $4 trillion trying to print inflation, trying to stimulate this economy where really, if you look at it, inflation is a stimulant because if everything, all the prices are rising, then you go and buy your iPhone today rather than next week.
Right.
Everywhere the wallets come out, everyone starts buying. You buy assets because they go up in value. That's why you want a little bit of inflation.
It gets a housing market going again.
Yeah, everything gets going again, right? People start employing because they're making more money and rah, rah, rah. But so you want some form of inflation. You want a contained inflation rate of like somewhere between 2% is what everyone's looking for. But I think everyone's been trying to get this 2% number. And maybe what we've done now is pushed ourselves to the other side where we end up with negative 5.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Well, stick around. We will continue discussing this point and hopefully give you more insight into what could happen versus what everyone's saying will happen. Sunny San Diego day.
That it is. We've had records, huh?
Quite warm. This global warming thing appears to be true on some days, and then we have the colder winters, although we didn't really see that here.
Yeah, I'm going to Hawaii tomorrow to cool down.
Oh, yeah. get out of this heat of San Diego,
exactly,
the sweltering
right.
San Diego weather.
Yeah. But
you probably claim it to be a business trip, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we've been talking about austerity, and I just wanted to fill people in a little bit about what that means. You know, an austere government means that what they're doing is they're not stimulating. They're not printing money. They're actually cutting back. They're trying to balance the budget. So really what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the two ends to meet, like we try and do with our household budgets. Mm-hmm. And that's the path that Europe's gone down. And Germany being a very staunch austerity proponer, because what they want, I mean, they've looked back in their history and they've been hit with hyperinflation a number of times and it hasn't worked out terribly well for them. So this time around, they're going, there's just no way.
Don't want to play that game again.
No, we're not playing that game. And
now,
we
with austerity, that's kind of letting the chips fall where they
yeah.
where they might versus what we've been doing here of let's just pretend the chips never started to fall and we'll try to patch things up as long as possible and then suddenly everything's miraculously going to be better and away we go.
Well, what they're trying to do is they're trying to smooth out the troughs, right. You know.
The volatility thing, which we've talked about in the past.
And there have been a number of studies done on this, but when you try and smooth everything out and you try and take some of this, like, can you imagine Spain's got unemployment rate at 25%? Could you imagine that in the U.S.? I mean, there would be, I mean, that's the Great Depression number was 25, I think. So the American public just doesn't stand for that type of thing. They're not prepared to take it on the chin in terms of that economic hit. And so what we do is we try and smooth the edges down. And that's what the Fed's trying to do. Well, the problem with that is, and we've seen it now repeatedly, we saw 2000 blow up. We saw 2007 blow up. We've seen a number before that, but those are the two that most people remember. And this time, the other two were, you know, tens of billions dollars worth of bet. I think the first one was $30 billion bet, and the second one was $150 billion, and now we're doing $3 or $4 trillion. So you just wonder, there's no way that it's going to just smooth out and come out the other side plain sailing. Right. It's never happened before. And so that's really where there's a lot of concern, and that's where the austerity methodology can win out the day, because at least at the end of the day, you might have a lot of people unemployed.
Right. There's a lot of pain.
Correct. But as a government, at least you're on relatively solid footing.
Whereas austerity's a little bit like just ripping the Band-Aid off.
Yeah.
And you know there's going to be pain involved, but it's going to be a lot shorter. It might be more severe pain, but it's going to go away quicker versus that real slow pull.
Right. And so, what you've got then is a situation in Europe where potentially they're able to balance the budget. So what they're bringing in taxes, they're able to spend. So there's no real drag. It's like a business who's cash flow positive and doesn't have a lot of debt. They're a very solid business typically, right? Versus someone else who's leveraged up to the hilt. And then if any type of ripple occurs, you know, if interest rates go higher, as I mentioned earlier, you have interest rates that go up. I mean, let's just rewind the clock back to the 70s. I forget what they were, but they were like 15% or something, didn't they go there?
Yeah, the 30-year treasury was even higher.
Okay, So let's just take 20. Mm-hmm. Okay, you take 20% on $20 trillion of debt, you've got $4 trillion of debt service. Your budget deficit is $4 trillion, and that's just from interest. Well, you're pretty much insolvent.
Right.
Because the only way you pay that is to print more money. So you're in a spiral now, you're in an insolvency spiral. And to me, that's where the way the Fed just keeps printing, and they actually believe they can just soak this money up without a problem. And I just don't see that. And that's where it's always ended badly.
Right.
And
it seems like the endings get worse and worse. Because,
they have to, because the numbers get bigger and bigger.
Right.
So I don't know what the ending's going to be this time. Hopefully this time we get really lucky. Mm-hmm. And I would actually I'm surprised that based on these unemployment numbers, they didn't just say, because unemployment's dropped so fast, we'll take $20 billion off of our stimulus. I'd like to see stimulus be nothing. Just let's stop the bleeding right now. But you can't really, because you still got a budget deficit of $600 billion. So you're still at a minimum printing $600 billion a year just to cover that.
You're going
to
create pain, but again...
Well, what pain, though? We're not improving anything.
But by pulling that money out, it's going to be perceived as pain.
Right.
How's that? That's maybe a better... Which would actually force interest rates down.
That's what I'm saying.
Because
people
would panic out of the market saying, it's not going to hold up. The money would flow directly into the bonds, and then we're liable to see the 30-year or the 10-year go down to 1%, maybe lower.
Isn't that bizarre? So you could have a weaker economy, but at least you're fixing the problem and the yields go down. And that's really what I'm seeing when I look out there. And as I say, it's not consensus at all. But I mean, I've had people ask me, so where do you think interest rates are going to be the next few years?
How high are rates going to go?
Is the common. Exactly. And to me, I'm thinking, well, how low could they go? First, I don't think we've seen a bottom in terms of the interest rate number. I think we could easily print a one something at some point, you know, maybe even a zero something. I don't know.
0 point.
Yeah. So I don't know if the US will ever get down there. The one thing, as I say, we've got against us in terms of reaching those numbers is the fact that we've got this massive deficit and we've got so much debt.
Now, you probably have a greater knowledge of this. Have there been situations where the tax revenue we were bringing in was actually greater than the money we were spending?
Yeah, with Clinton, remember? We had that little blip for about 2 years and everyone... Actually, there was mass panics in the market because people were going, hey, all the bonds are going to be bought up by the government. There's going to be no government debt. Where are we going to invest our money? There was major panic in the streets. Mm-hmm. I don't think that'll happen this time around.
No, I don't either because it's that number keeps widening.
Well,
widening.
Back then, I forget what the number was, but it was probably 5 or 6 trillion. So then it was like, wow, and they were printing $500 million of profit every year. So you took 5 trillion and was like, wow, in 10 years' time, there's going to be no government bonds.
And then our senators and congressmen found new special interests to get involved.
Yeah, we fixed that pretty quick, didn't we?
New projects and new committees to form to spend money.
Yeah. So now we're at 17 trillion, headed well on our way to 20. If we suddenly started printing a $500 million surplus, you know, that's 40 years before you soak up all that debt.
Right.
And when have we ever seen that? 40 years of budget surpluses.
Well, but with that, it probably wouldn't take that long because a lot of those bonds that are outstanding that the Fed's been purchasing will be paying off.
Yeah, but you've got to still pay them off, not with new debt. You've got to actually buy them, right? If you're not issuing, if it comes time to redeem a bond and you don't have the cash to give everyone back, what they do is they just issue new bonds. And that's really what we do. We just let the wheel roll.
Oh, yeah. It's rare that the bond actually gets paid off. It gets refinanced. Just like refinancing a house. You pay it for so long, you get tired of paying 7%. When the market's 4%, you go out, refinance it, and get a lower loan.
But what you'll also see, I'll tell you right now, if you see this yield curve start flattening much more, I wouldn't be surprised to see, if I was in the government right now, I'd be saying, if we can get this yield curve to flatten just slightly more, let's start issuing 50-year bonds, 50, even 100-year bonds, because then you're locking in 3-4% for 100 years, and then you've got bought yourself a ton of time.
Well, but knowing how the politicians are managing things, they would abuse that to death.
Oh, I'm sure they would, but I'd be dead before I have to witness all of that. But I mean, really.
It just goes back to the whole kicking the can down the road.
Correct. But at least then, you're right. You're definitely right, Dan, that if you can actually find a situation where you can actually balance the budget and you don't even have to have a massive surplus, take your $20 trillion, farm it out into 50 to 100 year of debt, lock it in at these low rates for 100 years, you know GDP is going to grow over those 100 years. So your debt as a percentage of the economy then becomes manageable. Your interest payments are always manageable. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you've now got a solution. But the problem is these guys in Washington, as you say, they will abuse.
Well, absolutely. If they did that and now all of a sudden, wow, look, we freed up X amount of cash, I guarantee they're going to find something to spend that because they all have.
Well, don't worry. We've got that already in our back pocket. We've got Social Security that could be a $100 trillion hole. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that no one even talks about that. But that ugly beast is going to rear its head pretty shortly. I don't know when. But
the baby boomers.
Well, we're all getting there.
Right. Well, but that's going to be the biggest strain on that whole system and really show the holes.
But that system, I'm not too worried about that because all they have to do is raise the age of retirement. And boy, that's almost like a magic wand that fixes that.
They've been doing that. I mean,
yeah,
for you or I, how old do we have to be now? I think I'm at least 67, maybe 68 now before I can reach full.
So it is happening. Mm-hmm. And so that'll fix that. So I'm less concerned about that. The one major one that we haven't even chatted about ever is this whole Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And that could be a massive hole, but who knows what that's going
to
be.
Yeah, we still, I don't think, have devoted a whole show to that and all the impacts. Maybe one of these days we will. But
I think it's more than one.
It's so many pages.
yeah.
I wouldn't even want to see it sitting on my desk. It wouldn't support it.
Remember that filibuster they had once where the guy, they said you have to read the whole, it wasn't Obamacare, it was some other bill and it was a few thousand pages long. So they hired one of those fast talking people to try and talk through it in an afternoon.
Fly through it. Well, this is the Portfolio Doctors. And if you have any questions that you want to reach out to us, if you want to listen to any of our old shows from a podcast, if this is your first time tuning in, you can hear more of us on theportfoliodoctors.com. If you have a question for Steve or I, you can reach out to us via email. My email is dan@theportfoliodoctors.com, and Steve's is steve@theportfoliodoctors.com. Stick around. We'll continue to point you in the right direction. Doctors, enjoying this sunny day. We've been talking about inflation, hyperinflation, deflation. Deflation.
Yeah, we've spent a lot of flations.
all of the above.
But the important point really is how it's impacting your portfolio. And the reason we bring it up and hammer it out so much today is because the outlook that you have for inflation has a huge impact on your overall portfolio returns.
Right, and we've talked about this a time or two. Your own personal inflation rate is what you need to be looking at all these items and how your personal inflation rate is impacted. It doesn't matter what the country's inflation rate is if it's your own situation. A great example we've discussed is the fact where you are, you're only a mile from your office where you live, really spend no money on gas, and your son's old enough now to where you're not having to cart him all around everywhere, where in my situation, I've got two young children who are just getting into the soccer days and t-ball and gymnastics and just line up all those activities. My personal inflation rate for that is just starting to accelerate.
Right.
And so I need to take that into account when I'm planning my personal finances, where you're doing the same thing. And you as a listener need to take all of that into account and say, well, gee, what's happening in my life over the next few years that could cause me to spend more or spend less? And that is your personal inflation rate.
No, exactly. I mean, it sort of sounds comical, but I love to paddleboard. And so I like to get a new paddleboard and keep up with the new technology.
You have to.
You have to do that.
You cannot paddleboard as well with
of course
inferior.
Not. You've got to blame it on the board. I mean, you can't say the guy on the board is the problem. But no, but just as an example, 2 years ago, I bought a new board and it cost about $1,800. And today I bought the new fancy updated version of that one, which is now better because the technology is better. So that's already an increase in improvement, supposedly. And the board cost $1,500. So there's a $300 savings, which is, what's that? I mean, that's 15%, just 18% reduction in the price of the board, right? There's a classic example of deflation.
Well, the other one was technology.
And that's a benefit. So I'm getting a benefit for less.
Correct. And the same thing, like technology-wise, if you're thinking about buying something today, like the big screen TVs.
Yeah.
I remember when plasmas came out, my dad paid a big amount just a short time after they first came out. You can buy that same TV for a few hundred dollars now.
Right.
And it's a huge TV, beautiful TV, and he paid a lot more than a couple hundred dollars for this TV. And it's out there every day, so it can be something you can use to your advantage. If you know, okay, the TV is looking like I'm going to need to replace it, if I just wait a short period of time, even as little as 3 or 6 months, you might save hundreds, if not thousands of dollars on that.
And that's deflation at work.
Right.
Interesting story. We didn't even have TVs. They didn't have TV in South Africa when I grew up.
Is that right?
Yeah, it didn't exist. And then we finally, when I was about 12 or 13, they had the first TV came on.
You're a lot older than you look.
And we stared at the test channel for like 15 minutes, tuning the test channel. You guys don't even know what the test pattern is, but when you don't have TV, that's all you get are the lines, the colored lines. And we'd tune all that, and eventually it would flash into life. And then for an hour, you had the news, and then that was that for the day.
Nice.
Three to four.
And everyone gathered around. I remember hearing the stories about that with the radio with my grandparents.
Oh, yeah, that's what we used to listen to as a radio.
Yeah.
So anyway, but yeah, so deflation, inflation, I mean, these things have a huge impact on your, if your outlook is, if you agree at all with our outlook, which, or my outlook, should I say, which is a low interest rate environment for an extended period of time, that puts a lot of pressure on your portfolio to provide you the returns that you need to be able to live as a retiree. Mm-hmm. On top of that, if you're expecting returns of 6 to 8% on your portfolio as a whole, and you've got this massive drag from the safe money, which being your cash, your bonds, your money market funds are all earning, let's say, 2% or lower, it means that the balance of your portfolio, and oftentimes that's 40% of your portfolio, so 40% is earning 2% return, and the other 60%, in order for you to get 8%, and that's up in the 14% range just to be able to get you to your 8% number.
Right.
You know?
That's a big, big impact on what you can Correct. Do and what you have to do in order to
And the risk you take up there, yeah. I mean, you're in the stratosphere. You're talking your whole investment is in private equity.
Right.
That could go to zero in an afternoon.
Or in high-flying, say, tech stocks or
yeah, and
prime
you've seen
example.
It, I mean, yeah.
Which, yes, that could work out, but it could just as well go to zero almost overnight.
Well, it worked out great for the last 3 years, but it looks like it's not working out so well. I mean, you had things like Triple D, which was at $90 a share. It's at $40 a share. I mean, you know, and that all happened in the last 6 weeks. So, I mean, you've got these types of stocks that just get pulverized really quickly, but that's how you make your money. But it's high risk, high return. And as a retirement person, you can't take those risks.
Right. And with that, if you are pretty close to retirement and you think any of this that we talk about has merit, there are things you can look at and utilize. They're not brand new, but they're still relatively new in 401k plans. And now they're starting to become available in IRA type accounts. Is what's called a stable value fund, where there is an insurance type feature to it that typically guarantees some type of minimum rate of return. It's not a big number, but at least it's a positive number.
And what's so it like, three?
I think three is the most common one I've heard. I would imagine there's some in the two to three range. I don't know. Each one's a little bit different. There's not tons of information out there because they are primarily only available in retirement accounts like 401ks, but that wouldn't be the worst place to put your money. That might be one of the best places you could put your money to, like we've talked about, to not lose it.
No, exactly right. I mean, there are other alternatives, but we're not allowed to actually tell people on the air what those are. But if you want to give us a call, we can discuss it. But
yes.
Those people who have called me and have got involved, I mean, you know, they're getting higher rates than that. And it's helping people, which is good news. That's
right.
Really why it was set up.
Right. And you have to understand there are a lot of regulations that we would have to talk to people individually and see if something like this makes sense to point them in the right direction.
Which is why we
so
can't mention it over
right.
there.
Right. And so with that, if you want to reach out, you can email either of us, dan@theportfoliodoctors.com or steve@theportfoliodoctors.com. You can also give us a call, 858-764-7250. That's 858-764-7250. Just leave a message there and we'll get back to you quickly. If there's any info, just leave a message saying I'm interested in learning more about some of the alternatives, or even just leave a message, something you want us to cover in more detail in the coming weeks, and we'll do our best to get back to you. Steve, you feel like giving out any more books?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, you got that stockpile at your office, so...
It's getting pretty low right now. Yeah, I'm giving them away left and right, so I might have to go out and get some more.
Uh-oh. Well, what do you want to do, 5, 10?
Yeah, I think I've only got 5 left, so let's give those away.
Okay. We will give out 5 of Steve's books to the first 5 listeners who either email or call and leave a message on that number, 858-764-7250. Or email to either of us, dan@theportfoliodoctors.com or steve@theportfoliodoctors.com. And again, if you're a first-time listener and you like what we've been talking about, our podcasts are available on iTunes, or you can go to our website, theportfoliodoctors.com. Well, get out there, enjoy this weather we're having. That's why we live here. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Portfolio Doctors on ESPN 1700. To schedule a financial health check, go to theportfoliodoctors.com. Or to speak with Dan Osgood, Steve Bick, or any guests on this program, call 858-764-7250. That's 858-764-7250. Or go online at theportfoliodoctors.com. That's theportfoliodoctors.com. The Portfolio Doctors are Dan Osgood and Stephen Bick, who are investment advisor representatives of their respective registered investment advisor firms, ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management Company LLC. The opinions expressed by the Portfolio Doctors and guests on this radio show are their own and do not reflect the opinions of this radio station. All statements and opinions expressed are based upon information considered reliable, although it should not be relied upon as such. Any statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Moreover, no listener should assume that any discussions or information presented serves as the recipient of or a substitute for personalized advice from ACAS LLC, Cottingham Management LLC, or from any other investment professional and is not intended as an offer of solicitation for sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management LLC are not law or accounting firms, and no portion of this presentation should be interpreted as legal, accounting, or tax advice. Information expressed does not take into account your specific situation or objectives and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for any listener. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from a qualified tax, legal, or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation.